for the friendly incoming. Only a couple of hours had passed since we'd sprung the ambush, but now, to look at the orchard, it might have been days. There was not one dead Chinaman to be seen. Not one. There were plenty of pools of blood, a lot of spent brass, but no fallen warriors. Shit, I thought to myself. Maybe it didn't happen. The Chinese had responded that quickly to the task of pulling out their dead, wounded, and weapons. Our final report, one blood-stained, well-pruned orchard. No corpus delicti. The Chinese were pretty slick. A new outfit set up across the river from the raider camp. I did not like such close neighbors. That's why I'd selected such an isolated spot in the first place, far away from any other unit so the guys could let their hair down without complaints from sleepless rear echelon folk in the wee hours of the morning. From the start, I'd also decided we'd have no hangers-on in the camp, no fat logistics tail to cut down on our fighting strength. Raider personnel performed such secondary jobs as cooking, driving, and administration, like Jack Sprinkler, the Raider's clerk who got the job because he was the only one who would admit he could type. But every swingin' Richard in the outfit was a warrior first. Now, suddenly, our lean, mean crew was being crowded out, and I wanted to know by whom. Chris made a quick recon and reported back that the intruder was the regimental bakery. The regimental bakery officer, he went on to say, was none other than Lieutenant Barney K. Neal, who had saved our platoon's ass back in April when G Company was overrun. What the hell is Barney K. doing as the regimental bakery officer, I wondered. I didn't believe it. I refused to, until an hour later when Barney himself arrived at the raider camp. And he was down. Just one look at him told me how badly he was hurting. But it wasn't until we sat down with the bottle of hooch that I found out why. Simply put, he'd cracked on the battlefield in the same attack that killed Jerome Sudet. But no story is that simple, and the one that Barney Kay related told me plenty. Only days before the operation, the stated purpose of which was to straighten up the lines around Hill 1062, Papasan, that huge thorn in the United Nations forces' side, destined never to be removed, the newest battalion CO apparently decided that Barney K was too familiar with his platoon. The night before the attack, the CO transferred him to George, which was spearheading the operation in the morning, as a replacement platoon leader. At the best of times, taking over a unit isn't easy. Before a big attack, it can be a horror story. No one knows you, no one trusts you, and it'd be fair to say the reverse is true as well. The one thing Barney K had going for him was Master Sergeant Moore, one of the few black soldiers to serve in G Company besides Jerry Boyd. Moore had come to George as an AWOL volunteer from some rear echelon quartermaster outfit, and had worked his way up from rifleman to platoon sergeant in an all-white outfit, a remarkable feat in a unit heavy with Johnny Rebs. Moore was a damned good man, but it was no consolation to Barney K, who, until that moment, had been the longest-serving platoon leader in the battalion. In Korean combat so far, the average platoon leader lasted no longer than a month. Barney K must have had 9 lives. In 10 months straight of heavy, heavy combat with Fox, he'd never once been hit, though he'd seen his platoon turn over through bullets at least 5 times. It was almost as if he was now being punished for living so long. The new battalion commander had used his eyes, but not his head. He'd seen overfamiliarity, but had not taken time to think, to realize that Barney K's easygoing attitude with his guys came from the platoon's and its leaders' mutual understanding, respect, and trust. With one order, the CO had destroyed it all, and my friend was heartbroken. At first light the following morning, just as they were about to jump off, Barney K's new unit started getting the shit blasted out of it with chink mortar fire. A 120mm round landed nearby, a little too close for comfort, but Barney K wasn't touched. Scared, yes, and ears ringing, but otherwise, physically, intact. But he couldn't take it. He told Sergeant Moore to take command and walk down off the hill. Shoot him, court-martial him, or give him a medal, no one seemed to know what to do. Probably the powers that be thought he'd gotten a bad deal, which he had, like a jockey whose horse had been pulled out from under him and another thrust in its place just moments before a big race, so they gave him the job of bakery officer. Barney Kay stayed at the Raider camp more than he did at his place of business. All the Raiders loved this infinitely lovable Oklahoman. They knew what he'd been through, and that he was a good man. So they jollied him out of his depression and gave him back his dignity. Meanwhile, I got the straight skinny on the army I could expect to find stateside. Barney Kay told me about protocol in the officer's world. I tried to put him back on his horse, too. Again and again I invited him along on our raids. But while again and again he promised to be there, on the night itself, he never was. Barney Kay's bottle had filled, and only time would empty it. The regiment was changing. The old warriors were fading out, and new leaders, straight from the stateside army, took informality and comradeship as signs of a loose, sloppy, undisciplined outfit. The irony of it all was that while General Van Fleet was telling the world that the reason for his 8th Army's limited large-scale attacks was that a sit-down army is subject to collapse at the first sign of an enemy effort, and that he couldn't allow his forces to become soft and dormant and slip into a condition that eventually would cause horrible casualties, his new COs seemed to be hurrying the negative process along by punching huge holes in morale. One captain, for example, introduced himself as the new CO of Proud George Company by telling that unit if he saw one man from the company run, probably referring to the bullshit bug-out tales of the past, he'd shoot him in the back. Fortunately, we Raiders had a patron saint in Colonel Sloan. Nobody, but nobody, messed with us. We had no visits from higher headquarters, no staff inspections, no checks to see if we were following regulations right to the letter. We'd get a mission order that said, do it, and we trained and planned as we saw fit. We wrote the book for the sort of things we were doing, instead of blindly following field manuals that didn't always apply. Sloan trusted me, so I had total freedom to get the job done. I trusted my NCOs to help me do it. My guys trusted me to stand up and fight if someone tried to screw us over, and I trusted Sloan not to use us as a kamikaze force. And it worked. The Raiders were the cockiest, most gung-ho sons of bitches on the block. The men approached each raid with superhuman confidence, knowing just as well that it could be their final journey. Last-minute wills would be drawn up. If you get killed, I want your jump boots. Oh yeah, if you get killed, I want your knife and watch. But the wills weren't signed or even sealed with a handshake, and since no one was getting killed, it was a big, fun game. Sure, you'd have gotten those boots if the guy who was wearing them bought the farm, but trust was what made the guy with the boots risk his life on the battlefield when you said, I'll cover you. He knew you'd keep him alive because you wanted him alive far more than you wanted his goddamn boots. Trust meant you'd risk your life for your buddies, because you knew they would do the same for you, and they'd never leave you dead or dying on any hill for any reason. Trust was a magic word with the wolfhounds, but it was falling out of use a little more as each new boatload of senior stateside officers unloaded. Something was happening to the combat army of the past year, but I couldn't put my finger on it. The new people knew all the cosmetic stuff, how to shine your shoes until they gleamed, how to stand ramrod straight and click your heels at appropriate moments. I'd learned all that peacetime discipline in Trieste. Good stuff at times, but it just didn't go well on the battlefield. The yes-sir, no-sir boot-licking business had gotten into our army through the influence of the British, the French, and the Germans way back in the von Steuben days of 1776. We'd modeled our system after theirs, and the incoming commanders knew the routine cold. They'd learned everything except that combat is no place for martinets. The Raiders were a damned disciplined unit, no less so because no one called me sir. I treated the guys as I wanted to be treated, fair, square, and honest. We operated on mutual respect. They knew I loved them, and they knew I'd never ask a man to do anything that I had not done on the battlefield or wouldn't do again. So we called on one another by our nicknames. There was rarely any pulling rank, and even when guys had a little too much sauce, there was no breakdown of Raider authority, or submerged hang-ups ticking away like bombs, waiting to explode when sufficient booze had been slurped up. Except, I think, the night when Chief decided to kill me. All Indians in an army unit seemed to be called Chief. In Italy, in the 752nd, it had been Chief Robert Ventura from Texas. This chief had been my Indian Al Hewitt. Ventura was an old man of at least 23 when I was 16. He'd fought through Europe and the Pacific during the war, and I was in awe of him. With or without firewater, he was a powerful guy. He could lift a Sherman tank's heavy engine compartment door single-handedly, or shoot all the bottles off a wall in a village bar, like in some Western movie, and not get caught only because the barkeep was afraid to even look at him. With his friend Polk from Virginia, Ventura taught me old soldier tricks, among them two vital uses for gasoline. One, to kill crabs, you take a shower with it, and two, to wash tank engines, you pour a 55-gallon drum into the engine compartment while the tank is revving up. They taught me the first of these outdoors in the dead of winter. I'd never forget watching Polk hold a 5-gallon drum of 80-octane gasoline over Ventura's head, while the chief stood under it, rubbing and scrubbing the crabs away in the sub-freezing temperatures. It would have killed an ordinary man. The engine cleaning shortcut was not nearly as memorable, except in its potential. One stray spark would have blown the tank, its basic load of HE ammo, 71 rounds of 76mm shells and thousands of rounds of 30 and 50 caliber, and all of us to kingdom come. But Polk and Chief weren't afraid of that or anything. And besides, that's how they'd done it the whole way from Africa to Germany. And if I was going to emulate them, I couldn't be afraid either. So I wasn't. In the Raiders, our chief was Chief Denny from Arizona. Denny was a great, powerful stud of a guy. He was a super soldier, an original Raider who'd come from Third Bat. He was also the silent type, who never seemed to say a word about anything. One night, we were all sitting around in a GP medium tent having yet another after-the-raid party when, out of nowhere, Chief decided he was going to kill me, and the only reason I could think of for him wanting to kill me was that I was an officer. All I knew for certain was that I was sitting on the ground in the center of the tent, drinking and bullshitting and leaning against the tent pole with a canteen cup of Raider booze in my hand, when suddenly I looked up to see Chief swinging a pick-matic down on my head. Luckily, the 190 proof had not zeroed me out completely. I rolled to one side, and the pick plunged into the ground exactly where I'd been sitting. It took half a dozen Raiders to wrestle the chief onto a nearby cot. They tied him down with commo wire and left him alone until the next morning. When we cut him loose, he didn't remember anything about the night before. I certainly wasn't going to mention it, and even though we did lock up all the picks to be on the safe side, nothing like it ever happened again. Every weekend, I sent a few Raiders back to Seoul for a little unofficial R&R. Besides the readily available pussy there, which kept the guys happy and out of trouble, Seoul was a scrounger's paradise. On one such journey, the boys brought back a full generator and lighting set in exchange for a few captured weapons. On another, one Raider returned with a large refrigerator, which he told me fell into his truck as he was driving past a Seoul officer's club in the early hours of the morning. But even with the essential items that kept finding their way into our camp, I was always bellyaching that we didn't have enough vehicles. We had three Jeeps, one authorized and two hot, but more times than not they were out with some joyriding Raiders and never there when I needed one. The final straw came when I had to report to regiment, a 10-minute Jeep ride, and had to drive a 2.5-ton GMC truck, of which we had two, one authorized and one hot. But that was not the point. What, I asked myself, is the leader of the Raiders driving a truck for? Would Lieutenant Patton drive a truck? Would Lieutenant Rommel? I was very pissed off. I tore Chris's ass. Three fucking Jeeps, and I've got to take a truck. I want one Jeep here at all times, my own personal Jeep that no one but no one will even look at. Do you understand? I immediately regretted blowing up at him, but of course would not apologize. None too popular that night. I went to bed early to do some hardcore sulking. I woke up about midnight to the blinding headlights of a Jeep, which was sitting in the middle of Chris's and my tent. On the hood and all over the damn thing were very mellow raiders who'd rolled up the side of the tent and pushed the vehicle through. Chris stood nearby. I knew he was still pissed over the ass-chewing I'd given him because he smartly saluted and said with the utmost correctness, "Here is your own fucking personal quarter-ton, Lieutenant." He stormed out of the tent, the other raiders in tow. It was all quite humbling. I had to get up, reverse the Jeep out of the tent, roll down the side, and wait for Chris to come home to thank him. So much for pulling rank. In the morning, all was forgotten as the raiders' shared mission became to make this Jeep our own. Chris had stolen it earlier the night before from the 35th Regiment's medical company. All 35th markings, bumper numbers, and cacti insignias had to be painted over and our markings and wolfhound heads painted on instead. Each military vehicle had a War Department number on it as well, and we assigned the same number, Raiders 1, to all four of ours. So if a Jeep was stopped, we'd just produce the trip ticket and no one would be the wiser. The only problem was we could never park them all in one place at the same time. In the Raider camp, it wasn't too much of a problem, though, because we allowed few visitors. Besides Barney K. Neal, the only people who saw the inside were Raider volunteers, buddies from the trenches like Phil Gilchrist, whom I'd invite to watch the Raiders train, I was so proud of my boys, were poker players. Poker was still big on my list. Our games were frequent, with good-sized pots and big-league pro players brought in for the challenge. I won a lot, so I always had a big bundle to donate to Del Evans whenever he came to collect. The consensus of Raider opinion was that Del must have been a Mississippi gambler in another life. I could never beat him. Once I had him for a few $100, but given that he'd taken thousands from me over the last year, it just wasn't enough, so I persuaded him to shoot craps. Del wasn't too interested. Just two guys shooting craps, hack, but he took me on. A short time later, I was completely wiped out, and, according to Del, still mumbling to myself when he pulled away in his Jeep. But my brand new Raiders 1 was compensation enough for any other losses. The only other person who was allowed to touch it was Bobby, who loved it as much as I did. The two of us were like little kids with the new toy. Bobby washed it, polished it, and kept it shiny for his combat dad, and in return, whenever I went for a drive, I took him along. One afternoon, we decided to pay Del a visit at the 2nd Battalion Forward CP. We picked him up and spun down the main supply route, MSR, through the 2nd Bat positions and on toward the U.S. main line. The battlefield was deadly quiet, as if the war had been shut off. It was a lovely sunny day, perfect for Del to see and feel my new set of wheels, and he was suitably impressed. Then out of nowhere roared a P-51 fighter. It was in trouble. Smoke was pouring out its rear, making a trail across the sky as the plane headed right into enemy lines. We gave chase as the fighter powered to gain altitude. Right in the middle of no man's land, the pilot bailed out. "Let's get him," Del shouted, and we zoomed down the road. Within moments, we passed a big sign that read, "You are now leaving the Wolfhound's lair. Northbound traffic should be able to speak Chinese," or something like that. But we could see the chute opening and the pilot coming down, and we were so caught up in the excitement of this adventure that we figured we could scoop him up and make it back to our lines before the Chinese were any the wiser. The first round smacked in front of the Jeep. A Chink SP gun was firing straight up the road. I slammed on the brakes. We unassed the thing, and by the time the next round hit behind the Jeep, Del, Bobby, and I were lying in a ditch on the side of the road in the middle of no man's land. Del gave Bobby his steel pot. The kid looked incredibly silly as he sat there beaming out from under it. The helmet had enough room for two little Bobby-sized heads. We had to get this Jeep turned around before the Chink gunner got its range, but the road was very narrow, so it wasn't a matter of a quick U-turn. I ran to the Jeep, and in the short lull between incoming rounds, went forward, then backed up, then went forward again before jumping out of the vehicle and hitting the ground as the Chinese gun blasted away. Forward, back, forward, over. Forward, back, forward, short. He was having as much trouble getting our range as I was getting the Jeep to head south. Finally, Dell and Bobby piled in and we got out of there. I don't know what happened to the pilot. The word was the 35th got him out, but I do know my hot little Jeep did very well on a very hot road, and one little orphan boy had not had so much fun in a long time. I can't say the same, though, for me and Dell. Night attack. We fell out, checked gear, loaded trucks, and moved. The raiders were about to take their first hill. Ironically, it was the same ridge I'd raided with Easy on 8 August, which had brought me to the raiders to begin with. The big attack, which had killed Sudet and knocked the fight out of Barney K. Neal, had pushed the main line forward as it tidied up the lines, and now the 8 August ridge was the U.S. front. It was strange riding down that road in perfect safety, seeing again the familiar landmarks, the bombed-out bridge that had saved our asses, now rebuilt, the S-turn in the road where once stood a lone Chinese sentry illuminated by a flare, the hill itself jutting up from the ground. The front line was still far to our front. Since September, the raiding business had gotten very serious. It was no longer easy to slip through the front lines and disappear behind enemy positions. The Chinese had wised up to raider activity, and were countering with raiders of their own and with damn good ambushing and observation teams. Meanwhile, regular units were slowly atrophying, as Van Fleet had predicted, in long, windy trenches that snaked from one side of the Korean Peninsula to the other. Barriers, booby traps, and alert listening posts, LPs, now filled the little holes that in the past we'd virtually meandered through. The enemy hugged the Allied positions with their own siege-like trenches. They had to in order to avoid U.S. superior firepower. In some places, the lines were within hand grenade range. The war had become a contest between a modern industrial state and a regime of fast-digging primitives who had little but numbers on their side. Limited major attacks by both sides to keep the pressure on seemed to be the politics of the peace table at Panmunjom, far more so than practice for the troops. Special units like the raiders were springing up all over the front to take up the slack and carry on the day-to-day fighting. So while Truman sent the word to keep casualties at a minimum, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Omar Bradley, visited the Korean front, and while the Pentagon recommended the use of nuclear weapons if a large Chinese attack threatened our forces with military disaster, and the USAF conducted simulated tactical nuclear strikes on North Korean targets, the 8th Army's I Corps' 25th Division's 27th Infantry Regiment's 3rd Battalion's K Company position had become untenable in the daytime, and the raiders were on the road again. But then came the sneer. There go those big, badass motherfucking raiders. Chris slammed on the brakes, whipped the Jeep into reverse, and came to a screeching halt next to a loud-mouthed trooper. It was chow time for members of the 3rd Bat on the side of the road. The raiders were going to work, and we weren't in the mood for eating shit, especially the shit of someone from the battalion whose asses we'd come to save. The Chinese had dug a virtual siege line only a couple of hundred yards from K Company. Their manned spider holes made it impossible for anyone in King to stick his head up during the day without drawing a sniper shot between the horns. Our mission was to get rid of the whole shebang. I grabbed my trench knife out of my boot and held it to the wisecracker's throat. All right, Joker, if you're so big and bad, you can come with us. Under great protest, the guy was pulled into the back of my Jeep. I smiled. We'd just see who was big and who was bad. Jimmy and crew slipped through King's wire at first break. It was more like an ominous twilight, really. The full moon was so bright, I would have canceled the raid except for the fog. McLean went with them. He'd be trying out our newest acquisition, an infrared night device to knock off the Chinko P. The scope was mounted on a carbine, and McLean assured me, with the confidence only an ex-Marine Corps expert marksman can, that it was accurate to at least 40 yards. We needed it. Artillery could cover the noise of the shots, and we'd be hard-pressed to get past the OP otherwise on a bright night like this. Next, I pushed our captive out of the trenches and told him he was going to lead the way. The guy became totally unglued. He cried, he begged, but I wasn't having any of it. I thumped him with my weapon and shoved him up toward the enemy hill. More raiders slipped through the wire. By this time, Jimmy and Mac were far ahead, all set up. I was getting nowhere with the kidnapped, snivelling wise-ass, and he was so damned noisy I could see he was about to become more of a liability than the lesson was worth. I handed him over to Neary, with the instruction to let the bastard go after the elements had reached their probable line of deployment. Still, I figured the kid had learned his lesson. It would be a long time before the old green-eyed monster got the best of him again. Might even make him president of the Raider Fan Club, I thought. Three rounds of artillery smashed into the top of the hill. I didn't hear the carbine fire even though I was only 50 yards away. Sure enough, Mac had neutralized the two-man OP with two clean shots between the eyes. We'd hold on to that infrared device. The hill was steep and void of all vegetation. We inched our way forward, slithering along like snakes, carefully shifting loose rocks out of our path. One careless move, one tumbling rock down this artillery-battered hill could mean serious trouble. It would alert the defenders to 40 very exposed and vulnerable raiders right in their killing zone. When we got to the first Chinese trench, no one was in sight. Our artillery had driven the defenders underground. I covered Red Smalling, my old friend, from 3rd Easy as he poked his head into a bunker. At the same time, two chinks came down the trench. Small gave both a short burst from his stripped-down BAR, and the battle was in full swing. But the chinks had been had. Raiders were all over their positions, and the fight was almost over by the time the enemy at the top of the hill began their usual barrage of potato-masher grenades. While we were mopping up, Smalling got into a jack-in-the-box duel with one die-hard burp-gun-toting Chinaman. They went at it for a while, one popping up, firing, and going down, then the other, until finally both of them popped up at the same time. Smalling cut the guy in half, but the Chinaman's last burst stitched right up his left side with half a dozen slugs. "Hack," he said with Arkansan understatement, "I'm hit." His left leg was virtually shattered, but he was still mobile, so I told him to go down the hill and Doc Brakeman would patch him up. "What about my weapon?" he asked. SOP in Easy was if you were hit, you passed your automatic rifle on to some able-bodied guy. You didn't want to lose that kind of firepower on a hill. But we raiders had plenty, and besides, we were almost through up there. I told him to keep it. The cleanup continued. We had a few casualties, mostly from grenades being thrown by a couple of hardcore jokers in a bunker on the reverse slope of the hill. Johnny Skoshi Watkins, Tsukoshi is Japanese for little, a young kid of about 17 who was the size of a jockey with the heart of a lion, got a chunk of his own ass blown away, and dear old Rapelli had the tip of his generous Roman nose sliced off by a shard of grenade steel. I was especially sorry about Rapelli's wound. He owed me about $500 from Jawbone Poker, and it was a raider rule that if you got hit, you were cleared of local gambling debts. I always hated to see good money bleeding off a hill. Suddenly Smalling reappeared. "I thought you'd gotten the hell out of here, Red." "Yeah, Hack," he drawled in his lazy kind of way, "but I bumped into some gooks on the way out. I thought you should know." He went on to tell me that after Brakeman patched him up, he'd been heading back toward King Company's position when he'd run into 6 Chinese setting up a machine gun to our rear along our withdrawal route. He'd killed them all. But then, despite the fact his left side was almost paralyzed, he had felt he should come back to tell me. What a good man. After I sent Chris to deal with the threat, his force knocked off another dozen enemy and left a squad behind to secure our withdrawal route, I turned my attention back to the reverse slope bunker where those potato mashers were coming from. We couldn't use artillery because we were too close. Our own grenades, thrown blind, seemed to have little effect. The only answer was for one of Forte's bunker busters, a satchel charge composed of C4 explosive and a short fuse detonation cord. We'd just have to keep the enemy down and stop the incoming grenades long enough for the charge man to toss the thing in. McLean, that tall, brave, Semper Fi Texan, volunteered for the job. Just before he walked up the hill, he hung his patrol cap over the end of his weapon and thrust it far out in front of him. The cap dangled down like a Lone Star flag. Mac turned to me. "Right out of the sands of Iwo Jima, huh, Hack? Sit down, John Wayne." Grenades, ours and theirs, popped all around him as McLean made his way up the hill. He set his weapon down, armed the charge, and spun it around his head like a lasso. Yahoo! He flung it over the top. Goodbye, bunker. Goodbye, Chinamen, with your piss-weak grenades. An infantry platoon from King replaced us before dawn. It had been another good raider show. Mission accomplished. 4 friendly wounded and no dead. Statistics say that for every 3 Purple Hearts, there's 1 dead. God was keeping his eye on us, crazy young fools. Colonel Sloan had promised us a unit R&R after the 10th raid. Morale was high as we returned from yet another night assault on yet another small hill in front of the 3rd Bat. We'd had no friendly casualties for the dozen or so Chinese we'd killed, and in a few days we'd be in Japan. We carefully wove our way along King Company's patrol path, which cut through a triple strand of barbed wire and mines. No more than 30 yards from the fighting positions, an LMG let go a long, long burst. It must have been 30 rounds. I could see the tracers coming in one long, fiery flood. They skipped over my head by what seemed to be inches. I screamed, "Raiders! Raiders! Shut off that fire!" No one was hurt except the gunner. Chris jumped into his bunker and stomped him to a pulp. The gunner's platoon leader, NCOs, and fellow soldiers watched, silently condoning our on-the-spot raider punishment. The guy had been asleep at his post. He must have awakened and panicked when he saw our dark figures coming at him. Fortunately, his fire was as accurate and reliable as his vigilance. The bastard could have killed a dozen good men. Getting ready for R&R was almost as complex an operation as any raid. All we could leave in the camp was authorized stuff, which meant packing, storing, and hiding just about everything we had. The last thing we needed was some inspector to find anything irregular about our special unit. We'd grown accustomed to the luxuries of life, and the stakes were too high to leave the place anything but perfect. The biggest problem was our vehicles, most of which we ended up hiding in a deep draw behind the camp. My new Jeep went off to ordnance for engine repair, and when everything was squared away, Barney K. Neal organized a few of his bakers to stay at the raider camp for security. Barney K. himself came with us. Rest and recreation, or rape and run, it all depended on what manual you wanted to believe. But the rest was non-existent, and the rape was paid for in advance, so to a guy fresh from the front, R&R was simply 120 precious hours, all of which would be accounted for and none of which would be wasted. Lovely little girl sons floated between guys. Every 5 days they honeymooned with a new husband. The stars of the group were passed through units like a good weapon, many of them as proud of their outfit as regulars. "Me wolfhound girl son. Never happen me stay with cacti. You want cacti girl son? Go see Rosie." If we could have just frozen time. Countdown Korea began the minute you touched down in Japan. Even before the first sweet cold sip of fresh milk you'd had for a year passed your lips in the R&R center in Osaka or Tokyo. The hardest thing during those wonderful 5 days was to stop the clock running in your head. "Deep six the clock," you'd tell yourself, in a sea of booze, and drink some more to drown each tick, which brought you that much closer to the front. Eat, drink, and be merry. Finally, the world of death and horror is far away. Danger, that constant cruel companion who haunts you every day, is suddenly cut loose and left behind. The best clubs, the best steaks, the best girls are yours forever. Until a car backfires and you're hurtled back to the whole mad thing while frantically searching for cover in the middle of the Ginza Strip. I steered clear of the other raiders in Tokyo. Basically, I didn't want to cramp their style. Like a chaperone at a high school dance whose mission in life is to take names and kick half-bared asses out of darkened hallways and janitor's closets. I joined forces instead with Barney K. I didn't want the raiders to cramp my style either. And though Barney stayed true to his stateside bride, Belle, the two of us still managed to take the city by storm. 5 days and a 3-hour plane ride later, it was back to the front for most of us, and one mean shock. There were no smiling faces, no eagerness to pick up those Thompsons and go on a raid. Of course, this was probably for the best, given that it took almost a week before all the guys got back. About half of the raiders who'd gone to Tokyo had ended up in jail. One group had smuggled in a Chinese submachine gun, On a drunken spree, they'd shot out neon lights all over the Tokyo nightclub district. Another squad had infiltrated a nearby U.S. Navy club. They tried to drink all the rum, torpedo the ladies, and sink all the swabbies. All in all, the raiders hitting Japan as a unit had led to a pretty rough 5 days for the old land of the rising sun, leaving the natives only to shake their heads and rue the day they decided to bomb Pearl Harbor. Colonel Sloan was not amused by the conduct of his elite creation. The raiders had gotten into more trouble in 5 days than the whole regiment had in 6 months of R&R. We had sinned, but sinned good. No one suggested deactivating the force. In fact, Sloan's XO, Lieutenant Colonel Smith, a man so caring we called him Mother, did wonders to prevent Sloan getting the full skinny on the raiders' R&R escapades. But the good colonel did lock my heels together. He told me there would be no more unit R&Rs, and it was highly doubtful there would even be individual raider R&Rs for some time down the track. Your boys are all volunteers, and they're taking on extremely dangerous assignments. I don't expect them to be Boy Scouts. On the other hand, I cannot overlook gross violations of discipline, he said, suggesting I return order to the ranks muy pronto. Jack Speed, spokesman for the transgressors, explained their shit behavior the best. You know, Hack, you get over there, and they give you a goddamn steak and a glass of milk and all that, and you finally realize what life is all about. I don't know. We just went goofy. I understood, but it wasn't going to wash with Sloan. So I took the boys on long runs, especially close to the Wolfhound CP, all the while barking, "All right, you bastards, you think you're so bad?" And the colonel and staff could hear the raiders chant their mournful repentance. It took a different kind of leader to understand and handle the sort of animals I had on my hands. I was well suited for the job, mostly because I helped make them animals, and probably because I was one of the biggest animals of them all. So, for me as their leader, the worst part of the R&R business was not the embarrassment with Sloan, but the fact that the only difference between my boys and me was that I didn't get caught. It was just a case of a unit with spirit. Uncontrolled, maybe, but still spirit, which is the essence of success in battle. Spirit makes all things possible. Spirit is what made the raiders, and if, from the outside, it looked as if we had too much, that was something only I had to deal with. My boys didn't give a damn about rules and regulations, but neither did I. What was the point? Every day we lived with such danger, we kind of figured the next would be our last anyway, and if it wasn't, and we had to pay the price with higher command, what could they do? Put us back in the raiders and send us behind enemy lines? The Japan raid might well have been forgotten, but for two incidents. First, 2 weeks after our return, a couple dozen cases of clap appeared among the raider ranks. The regimental surgeon congratulated me for having my unit equal the regimental VD record for the past month. Second, the jeep we hid in ordnance was found by its owner. It seemed that a wise old motor sergeant from the Cacti Medical Company had recognized his missing chariot in my Raiders One. He must have remembered some little dent or other odd scars or modifications. He'd pulled out his jackknife, and a few careful scrapes across two coats of paint revealed the cacti insignias. "Sir, that jeep is not a Wolfhound jeep," I explained to Regimental XO Mother Smith. Unsmiling but sympathetic, Smith assured me he was well aware of this. But how, he wondered, did it come to have 27th Raider insignias? I couldn't exactly say. "Well, sir, the jeep was found on post, and some gumshoe artist was fiddling around, and suddenly our numbers were on the vehicle, and what the hell? It belonged to that rotten 35th Regiment." But I did. Colonel Smith was not amused. The 35th wanted a head. Someone had to be court-martialed. But he said he could probably do a deal. Hold the court-martial, satisfy the 35th's CO, lose the paperwork, and the matter would be forgotten. The Raider Mafia met before the sun set. "Why don't we tell the truth?" suggested Chris. "Scoshy got the jeep." "What do you mean, I got the jeep? Crispino, you're a lying son of a bitch," little Johnny Watkins cried as he grabbed his weapon and slammed a magazine into it. Chris belted him in the mouth. The blow sent Scoshy flying, but no one intervened. After all, Watkins had been about to blow Chris away. "Shit, Scoshy, I'm just pulling your leg," Chris told him as he helped the boy to his feet. "We wouldn't make you take the rap." "Okay, look," he said, turning to the rest of us, all business. "We'll tell the truth. I got the Jeep. I found it." Another voice chimed in. "Yeah, it was abandoned over near the shower unit. It wasn't locked or anything, and it was getting dark. Thought a Korean would steal it." "Yeah, so we brought it home for the night. Next morning, one of the guys was just screwing around and painted on our markings." "Right," said Chris. "By the time I woke up, the new Raider Jeep was on its way to Seoul for a scrounging trip. And when it came back, well, it was 3 days later and nobody had been asking about no Jeep. And then we'll tell them it belonged to the 35th anyway. And they're just a bunch of no-good sons of bitches, so we kept it. I'll take the blame." Chris was court-martialed by one of the regimental staff officers the next afternoon. He was found guilty, admonished, and fined part of a month's pay. The two of us drove back to regiment, pleased that the heat was off and justice had been done. We knew the guys had been worried. We hadn't told them about our backroom talks and that the court was fixed. Some things had to remain sacred. But as long as they were still in the dark, we decided to play out just one more scene in the drama. We arrived back at camp, our faces grim. Chris went into our tent and began to pack his gear. "How'd it go?" the guys yelled in unison. "What's he doing?" asked Johnny Winters. I told them that Chris was getting his no-good ass right out of the unit, that in order to save himself from jail, he had squealed on us and all of our unauthorized activities, the raiderettes, the other stolen vehicles, the rations, everything. A couple of the guys got so pissed off they grabbed their Thompson submachine guns and started for our tent as if to finish off the job Scoshy had tried to start the night before. I hadn't expected that. Our script called for a happy ending, not Chris's brains splattered all over the camp. I took the weapons away. "Look, let me handle this." Mercifully, on cue, Chris came out of the tent. As per script, we went to an open field about 300 yards from where the raiders were sitting. There, I proceeded to stomp the hell out of my friend. Then Chris started to stomp the hell out of me, a kick in the face, a fierce blow to the head, a thundering flip on the back. But it was all stuntman stuff, like buddies faking it on the back lot. Every boot and every blow was stopped before it sank home. Finally, we both got bored. It was time to wind the thing up. The finale came when Chris, the villain, kneed me. I rolled into a ball, and he started to finish me off with various kicks to the face. But like the true, clean-cut, all-American boy I was, I pulled myself up on his tattered uniform, cold-cocked him, and walked away victorious. "That'll take care of that squealing son of a bitch," I said, slapping my hands together as the rest of the raiders looked on in horror. "Let's have a beer." When Chris got up, dusted himself off, and joined the party, everyone had a good laugh. But it'd be fair to say the two of us had a hard time making the raiders believe much of anything after that. A few more good raids made regiment forget all our transgressions, and by late October there was not one hill or valley throughout the regimental sector that the raiders had not ventured across. It was indeed difficult to find an objective where we had not been before. Battlefield circumstances and Chinamen in depth had phased out our original raider role. Our mission assignments now came from operations. We had become the de facto regimental assault force. I was always on guard against higher headquarters playing games with my unit. I well remembered how the 8th Rangers had been misused and virtually destroyed in November, and most of the other specially trained airborne ranger companies in Korea met the same fate. Historically, special units have always been thrown into the breach to stem the tide. Everyone knows that 10 spirited fighters are far better than a herd of 1,000 listless dragasses. But many commanders on the Korean battlefield were beginning to behave like desperate gamblers, ignoring the reality that it was far easier for the planners to draw a circle on a map and claim it as a critical objective than it was for mortal men to seize it. So, with morale in the trenches already lower than whale shit, COs across the front were calling for well-trained, well-motivated cannon fodder, ranger raider specialists, to do the jobs their own doe-foots would or could not do themselves. It took great command wisdom not to ruin a fine thoroughbred by having it pull the plow when the mule was down. Colonel Sloan exercised this wisdom, and the regimental S3 Major Robert Glazer backed him up to the best of his ability. Glazer was a seasoned combat man with 2 wars under his belt. Until his recent promotion, he'd commanded a 3rd Bat Rifle Company, so he knew well how to keep his planners in tight rein and make certain the grease pencil warriors did not promote schemes that would put the raiders in serious jeopardy. Still, our missions were no longer based on stealth and skill, but rather on shock and firepower. It didn't help that little by little, through battle casualties and normal rotation, we were losing some of the original raiders. Fortunately, the replacements adopted our what-the-hell attitude, and we accepted each mission as we had all to date, fatalistically, even when it meant retaking a position in broad daylight. For 3 days, we'd sat in foxholes behind the 1st Bat, to whom we were temporarily attached. Indications had been that the Chinese would attack in force right down the center of the regiment. The raider role was to block an enemy penetration. If the guys ever thought they were prima donnas, this duty quickly dispelled the idea. Our position should have been held by a 200-man rifle company. We had less than a fourth of that number and were armed with only assault weapons, great for close-in stuff, but not red-hot in the defense. We did not have mortars and trenching gear or even steel pots. We were David waiting for Goliath, minus the slingshot. The Chinese threw a fair amount of artillery and mortar fire around but did not launch the expected attack. It was when they overran an outpost in front of A Company that 1st Bat decided to send their raiders to get it back in daylight. Why not? I guessed the rationale was that we were attached to them for the moment, so why get any of their own killed when someone else will go for free? The OP was located on a little knob about 600 yards from the main line. We moved up before dawn. I would have preferred making a night attack, but Lieutenant George Creamer of A Company had said that at night there was no way to crawl through the barbed wire and mines that previous U.S. defenders had laid on the slopes. We clobbered the hill with artillery and kept it pouring while we worked our way to the top in single file, disarming mines along the OP patrol path. The position did not have any tactical value to the enemy. The attack had either been a feint or a psychological exercise, a demonstration by kamikaze troops that the Chinks were the baddest guys in the valley. In any event, the Chinese raiders had flown the coop by the time we reached the top. I called the main line to tell them the goddamned position had been retaken courtesy of the raiders and that they could come out and relieve us any time they wanted. Now it was just a case of tidying up before they arrived. We stacked up the U.S. dead. It looked as if they'd been asleep at the switch. The Chinese must have slipped through their defenses and knocked them off all at once, and started cleaning up the position. Down below, a few of my guys began opening a wider path through the minefield for the relieving force. I went down to have a look. I moseyed around the position a bit, and when the boys yelled, "All clear," I started back to the top, only then noticing that one of my boots had tripwire wrapped all around it. Normal debris from diffused mines. I gave my leg a mighty kick to get rid of the stuff. My troops hit the ground, instantly. Before I could figure out why, a bouncing Betty exploded about 4 feet away from me, sending scores of ball bearings into the air. When the dust settled, I was still standing up, untouched. "What the hell are you guys doing down there?" I asked, as the boys slowly got up and looked at me in amazement. The fact was, my hearing had deteriorated a lot after I got hit in the head on 6 February. The only difference between the mine clearers and me was that I hadn't heard the click when the firing mechanism went. "Thought you fuckers had cleared this area," I barked, and hot-footed it back to the top of the knob so I could go into shock in private. It would just become part of the legend. "Let me tell you about our old man. Our CO doesn't give a damn about anything. You know how he clears a path through minefields? He just walks out and stomps and kicks. He blows the shit out of mines and isn't even touched." Or the time when Chris was chopping wood in front of our tent, standing there in his shorts, legs apart. His pistol lay on top of his rack. I picked up the weapon and squinted through the sights right between Chris's legs. What a tempting shot. I took careful aim at the log he was splitting, no more than 6 feet away, and squeezed the trigger, figuring the pistol wasn't loaded. Bang! The slug went between Crispino's legs, missed the log, and cut the axe handle in two as Chris followed through on a downward chop. It scared the shit out of both of us, but I pretended I'd hit my target. Bullseye! I never squeezed rounds off an unloaded weapon again. It was a lesson I should have learned years before when I overheard old Sergeant Walker in Italy counseling a young kid who'd playfully pointed his weapon at him. "Don't ever point a weapon at someone unless you intend to kill him," said Walker, who'd seen combat in Africa, Sicily, and Italy. "I know because some damn fool killed me that way, but when I got up to the pearly gates, St. Peter said, 'You're too young and too handsome to be here now. I want you to go back and teach all those young careless fools who point their weapons at their friends.' Even so, the legend only grew with stories like that. 'And yeah,' says another one of my guys in the rear, 'not only is the son of a bitch scared of nothing, but he can shoot an axe handle off an axe between a guy's legs.' I knew the minefield incident was built on bad hearing and the axe handle shot was just sheer stupidity canceled out by good luck, but that's the stuff a legend has to keep to himself. Soldiers need legends. It's a way to deal with the madness of war. Like the legend of Roger Young, a quiet, shy man who won the Medal of Honor in the Solomon Islands in World War II for leading a daring attack against strongly defended Jap positions. He died in the attempt, courageously ignoring his buddy's calls to stay down, and was immortalized in a number one hit song among the boys in Olive Drab. 'For the everlasting glory of the infantry shines the name of Roger Young.' Only after the war was it revealed that Roger Young was almost totally deaf. He'd faked his hearing test to get into the fighting, and his bravery on the day he died was most likely a result of not hearing the warning shouts of his friends. But it didn't matter by then. Roger Young was a legend, and his very name got many soldiers through the night. Living legends serve a similar purpose. If the troops can go into battle secretly knowing that among them lurks a Scooter Burke, a Superman in Clark Kent's ODs, they'll fight better, they'll fight harder, and they'll somehow believe that immortality is theirs too. But this presents a problem for a leader legend, because you reach a point where you can't let your men know you make mistakes. You just can't, even when it means you become trapped somewhere between who you really are and what they want you to be. All I ever wanted was to be a good soldier, and I was, but to myself, I was certainly not a hero. Inside, I was an embarrassingly uneducated, insecure kid of 20 with a terrible temper and lots of luck, both traits more than likely inherited from my Irish mother. Fury accounted for most of the heroic acts chalked up to my name. Going after that sniper on 6 February, where the whole legend began, was more than anything the work of a hungry Irishman temporarily off his nut. Still, on the outside, I played the role, and even encouraged the hero business. After all, showmanship is vital to being a good troop commander. The only problem was that my audience kept demanding encore after encore. Many, many times in a firefight, when the slugs were really snapping, I'd find myself snugged up close to a solid dirt wall or behind a tree enjoying perfect cover, and just as I'd begin thinking how comfortable I was, I'd start feeling the eyes of my command boring in, saying, "We're in a real tough spot here, baby. Just what trick are you going to pull out of the old hat to save our sweet asses?" And I always pulled out something, with one more wild or brazen stunt, confirming to my troops, and maybe to myself too, that I was the bravest dude on the block. Before Napoleon promoted a general to field marshal, he would ask one question: "Are you lucky?" And only if the answer was yes would Napoleon pass on the baton. I was lucky. That little bit of magic followed me as closely throughout my career as the smell of battle. And it followed the Raiders, too, in the fall of 1951, through dozens of raids behind enemy lines and within our own, irrefutable cases of insubordinate and wild behavior, and enough 190 proof to keep a hospital going for a year. Yes, the Raiders, my own little army composed solely of field marshals, were lucky. And we were going to live forever. 7. Hill 400. What made a guy write for the Raiders? You had to be someone who just didn't give a shit. It isn't a big deal to die, you know. Live with honor, die with dignity. That was the Raiders' slogan. See, Hackworth had pride in people. And for a 20-year-old man to be able to make a person want to fight and die and be happy about it? Shit. We were happy to die for our country. That's the kind of spirit we had in the Raiders. Master Sergeant Jack Speed, U.S. Army. Squad Leader, Platoon Sergeant, 27th Raider Platoon, Korea, 1951. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap whiles any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day. William Shakespeare, Henry V, Act 4, Scene 3. I never wanted to die, but I never feared death either. I guess I always knew that the price of admission to life was one owed death. My father and mother both paid it before I was a year old, and Uncle Roy just 8 years later, his a lingering death from the mustard gas and other wounds he sustained in World War I. With me, I figured when it came it would be with the roll of the dice. It was really a matter of luck and probability. The more missions, the more point duty, the more hot engagements, the higher the probability of getting zeroed out. And if you had to go, sure, you wanted to do it heroically, but real heroism, I believed, was just returning to the front. When you knew the score and how the game was played, and when you knew what it was like to have hot steel ripping through your body and your wounds healed in a ward full of kids your age who might never walk, see, and think the same again. On the occasions, and there were a good few, when death and I stood eyeball to eyeball, when I knew I'd used up my odds and in the next few moments I would be dead, I was always perfectly calm. There was no fighting, no raging to hang on. I was always perfectly at peace, and almost invariably I'd think to myself, so this is the way it is. What an uninspiring way to go. In its way, it was a good feeling, because then I'd settle back and rock into whatever was going, just as cool as ice. Men had been dying in battle for ages. What else was new? Live fast, die young, and have a good-looking corpse was how I and the rest of the Raiders saw it, along with John Derrick, who said it first in the 1949 movie Knock on Any Door. The only thing to do was not worry about it at all, and have the best damn time you could while you were around. Of course, being a leader helped. You were always too busy bringing in air and artillery, moving your people and shepherding your herd, to take time to focus in on yourself, on where you might be in a moment's time. On the battlefield, you become very superstitious. You're always looking for something that's going to protect you from being killed. It might be a photo of the girl next door. It might be a rabbit's foot, or a blanket. Yes, a security blanket, which you huddled under in the night. Phil Gilchrist's was a white T-shirt with a blue band around the collar. He never went into battle without it. My Chink Waltham watch might have become a lucky charm for me if it hadn't been knocked off in the hospital after 6 February. But as it was, I didn't need it or any other, because I had an inside thing with God. I prayed all the time, but early on I'd made a pact with myself. It was never, "Dear God, please look after me." It was always, "Dear God, please look after my men and make sure that no one gets killed." I suppose if I could have been objective about it, I would have realized that to lose men was just the breaks of the game. But I had built my little house of hope, and God dwelled therein. Since I'd returned from the hospital after the 6 February wound, which meant all of March until now, 1 November, we'd been in some really heavy combat, taking stacks of WIA, but among my men, we'd never taken any dead. The man and I were tight. "We've got a tough job for you," It will be the hardest one your outfit's had, Colonel Sloan explained to me quietly. How many men have you got, and how soon will you be able to jump off? Colonel Sloan's tough job was a raider assault on Hill 400, what the infantry school would have called key terrain. It was a rocky, volcano-shaped hill that sat astride the left boundary of the Wolfhound Regiment, dominating the battlefield like a Spanish hilltop fortress. The enemy had occupied it for a long time. According to intelligence, there were no more than 50 Chinamen up there, but the enemy had burrowed deep into the hill's rocky slopes, and despite all tactics used or vast firepower employed, the Wolfhounds could not secure that piece of ground. We were assured it was not a kamikaze attack. Instead, Sloan said that it was critical, and an operation perfectly tailored for our fleet-footed band of hill runners. Though I might have mentioned that this perfectly tailored operation had only been designed for the raiders after two or three different units of infantry had assaulted the hill, taking extreme casualties in the process, I accepted the mission without comment. But my gut started to churn. 400 was that Jake Abel feeling all over it.